Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jonathan Fulton about his new book, China's Relations with the Gulf Monarchies. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, James. Happy to be here.
I wonder if you could start by sort of telling us a bit of a, if you wish, an intellectual history of yourself and how you came to writing this book.
Sure. It's kind of a long and twisted tale, I guess, like most books like this. But I grew up in Atlanta, Canada, in a very small farming town called Sussex, New Brunswick. There's very little to do with either the Gulf monarchies or China. I graduated with a degree in political science, and I was really curious about the world. I wanted to travel and get out and explore a bit. So my then girlfriend and now wife and I ended up in Taiwan, knowing nothing about Chinese culture, language, Taiwanese history, really very little about it at all. And we were teaching English there for a couple of years in our early 20s. And it was great. We really got fascinated by the language and the culture and the history and started to delve deeper into it. And kind of got the taste for East Asia. We lived in Korea as well for quite a while. And we ended up moving to Abu Dhabi in 2006. And we thought we were only going to be here for a very short, you know, maybe a 2 or 3 year contract just to see a different part of the world. At that point, I decided I wanted to go into an academic career, and I was doing a master's thesis on China's energy relations. I was really curious about how its energy requirements were shaping its foreign policy. And I was also very interested in this Shanghai Cooperation Organization at the time. And I thought that was going to be the direction of my studies, was China, Central Asia. And kind of by a strange coincidence, the deeper I got into my research, the more I realized I actually lived at kind of ground zero of where I needed to be studying, you know, that China's relations with the Gulf were much greater than I realized, you know, even living here. I had always, I guess, like many people back in the late 2000s, considered the Gulf to be oriented towards the West and hadn't really given it much thought. But the more I started reading about it and learning about it, I realized that this relationship between China and the Gulf states is going to be pretty important. So, that's when I put my PhD application together and thought I'd research China-Gulf relations. And I guess when I wrapped that up, I immediately got onto the task of turning it into a book, which came together last year.
Right. In many ways, of course, there were a bunch of factors which you probably, since almost certainly, having been in the Gulf now for more than a decade, have witnessed, there have been a number of factors that have, in a sense, changed your perception, but also reality on the ground in terms of the orientation of Gulf states exclusively on the United States and their turn eastwards, among others, towards China.
Absolutely. I think that was the interesting thing, because I'm a political scientist. I do international relations. And a lot of the studies that I'd read, I mean, that was when I started this project, that was one of the harder things, was just finding current data and current studies, because there have been a lot of stuff published still in that kind of Cold War era. And a lot of the analysis kind of looked at it from a structural or systemic pressure kind of orientation, that the Gulf states were focused in one direction because of systemic pressures, and it had less to do with what was happening inside the countries. And the same thing with China, that it was more focused on East Asia, and it seemed kind of opportunistic, let's get the energy. And of course, in the past 20 years or so, we've seen more and more factors coming into play, that the international system pressures, like the what's happening in the U.S. and the Arab uprisings and 9/11, the changes in energy markets, China's Belt and Road. I mean, there's just so many factors that come into play. And then you add those together with all the things that are happening domestically within the Gulf states and China, and the new normal in the Chinese economy, and Gulf states trying to move to this post-rentier system. There's just so much happening that make it a really interesting set of relationships to study and analyze.
I mean, you describe a lot of this in your book, and fundamentally, China's relations with the Gulf states have become far more complex and multi-layered. You have now hundreds of thousands of Chinese nationals and thousands of Chinese companies operating in the region. What are the implications of all of these expanding relationships?
Oh, wow. Well, there's so much to consider. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's pretty obvious that the relationships, you know, a kind of an international relations perspective, the relationships with the U.S., it's rocky, but the security architecture that America has in the region isn't going away. I think U.S. military preponderance is going to be a fact here for quite a while. In terms of just the Gulf states wanting to diversify and look to different states, China's becoming a big one. The Belt and Road is expanding China's interests and influence in a lot of regions where it hasn't been traditionally, and the Gulf is a natural fit for a lot of what they're doing.
You've used the term a dense interdependence, and so how important is the Belt and Road? And if it's important, why is the Arab Gulf not included in the corridors that sort of constitute the initiative's backbone, if you wish? It seems to me that the absence of a corridor is remarkable, given that the Gulf is at the crossroads of Africa, Asia, and Europe, and the region's hydrocarbon reserves.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And it's something I've talked to Chinese analysts and academics and officials about. And I think there's quite a bit at play there as well. And the big one is, well, first of all, in terms of the economic corridors, those were announced, I think, in 2015, and that was kind of the architecture of the Belt and Road. And as you say, there was no corridor developed on the Arabian Peninsula, and that was quite shocking to me, because you see them, there's the China-Pakistan economic corridor and the China-Central West Asia that forks off into Iran and Turkey. And this is such a hub where they already had such dense layers of relations across almost every facet of the Belt and Road cooperation priorities. You know, for the Belt and Road, they want to focus on these five cooperation priorities of policy coordination, facilities interconnectivity, financial integration, free trade, and people-to-people bonds. And this is really the blueprint they followed for developing relations with the Gulf monarchies right across the board. They've been doing this for quite a while. There is no security component to these cooperation priorities. It's really all about development and economic issues. So it was very strange to me when I saw these corridors and thought, well, this is exactly the form they're using to develop or enhance relations with the GCC states. Why is there no formal corridor? And in my discussions with people, one of the issues that came up was that this was all announced back in 2013, and most Arab states were obviously very preoccupied with regional events. The Arab uprisings were taking a lot of their energy and resources. And speaking with some Chinese officials, they kind of indicated that they were they had come to the GCC states and proposed this idea, and they were a little hesitant given the fact that they were just focused almost exclusively on regional affairs at the time.
Go ahead, please.
And I also spoke with a Chinese diplomat who's in the Gulf, and I asked him about this and said, this is so strange that these relationships are so intense across a wide range of Belt and Road oriented endeavors. Why is there no corridor? And he said, we don't need it. You know, any type of bilateral cooperation is Belt and Road cooperation. So whether or not it fits into the formal structure of the BRI is less important than the fact that they're just really taking whatever they do together and calling it a Belt and Road cooperation project.
It also seems to me strange, not only because there's an absence of a corridor, and that seemed to be the architecture, but also because various Gulf states, particularly the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, have really positioned themselves in terms of ports, in terms of airlines, as global hubs in which Asia and particularly China plays an increasingly important role.
Absolutely. And I think what we're seeing in the UAE, I think in particular, they've been elevating relationships. You know, China doesn't use an alliance system the way the US does. They use these strategic partnerships. And it's a hierarchy of relations. And until now, the Iran, Saudi, and the UAE have all been given the highest, this comprehensive strategic partnership status. And that involves a wide range of economic and political and security cooperation. So those seem to be the three pillars of China's Persian Gulf or Gulf orientation. But Qatar is an important one as well. They're at the next level down, so is Oman and Kuwait. Bahrain, I think, is the only Gulf state that doesn't have an agreement yet. But Qatar is interesting because, as you say, they've been doing a lot of infrastructure development for the FIFA World Cup. They've been, you know, just a tremendous amount of infrastructure going on. Chinese firms have taken a big role in this. They signed something like $8 billion in contracts in 2014 alone. These ports, these airlines are really a big part of what China seems to be doing on the peninsula.
We'll come back to sort of the balancing of relationships between all of these states and what that means for China. But let's start with you've described in the book the weakening and possible demise of the Gulf Cooperation Council or the GCC, primarily as a result of the now almost 20-month-old crisis in the Gulf, in which Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have declared an economic and political and diplomatic boycott of Qatar. You've described that basically as a problem for China. Can you explain why that's a problem for China and whether that in itself is also going to make a possible future creation of a corridor more unlikely?
Sure. I mean, it's a problem for China on a couple of levels. On a very practical level, China has a preference for bilateral relations, but with the Gulf, they have been negotiating a multilateral agreement, a free trade agreement with the GCC forever now at this point. I think they started back in 2004, and there was about a two-year period from 2004 to 2006, where there was quite a lot of energy put into this, and then it just kind of fizzled. And when President Xi Jinping went to Saudi and Iran in 2016 for his first middle state visit as a president, this was one of the key takeaways that he said he wanted within, by the end of the year, he wanted to see this free trade agreement revived and some positive momentum towards it. And they held, I think, six rounds of talks throughout 2016. And they weren't quite there yet, but it was pretty close. Closer certainly than they'd ever been at that point before. And with this, I guess, breaking of the GCC, or what looks like the breaking of the GCC, I don't know how you construct a multilateral agreement with a broken organization. So that certainly is an issue, I think, that weighs down on China in the region. The other one is just China prefers stability, you know, as most great powers would. They don't want to see a problem between, you know, port partners. They've got very strong, obviously, the trade relations between China, or economic relations between China, Saudi, and the UAE are much, much greater. But Qatar is also considered a pretty important partner. They get a lot of natural gas from Qatar, and they've last year signed an agreement to ratchet that up quite a bit. I think it was a 20-year agreement. So they don't really want to see a problem between, you know, states that they have pretty important relations with. They've been quiet behind the scenes, I think. You know, Foreign Minister Wang Yi had talked about playing a mediator role and saying he wanted to see a diplomatic solution. But I think it's really out of anybody's hands. It seems to be the Gulf states have to solve this themselves. If I guess that's the takeaway from the past 20 months or so. And I think China just wants to position itself so that it's not stuck on either side, but able to kind of keep a foot on both sides of this dispute.
It also strikes me that, you know, in many ways, China is totally aligned with the rest of the international community, which basically wants to see the Gulf crisis go away. And you could argue, in practical terms, has adopted the Qatari position by calling for negotiations, you know, to end this crisis and run up against basically the Saudi and the UAE refusal to even entertain a negotiation without their conditions having been met. Which leads me to a more fundamental question, which is whether Chinese policy in the region is sustainable. You mentioned the January 2016 visit by Xi Jinping to the Middle East, including to Saudi Arabia, and that right before the that visit, China sort of articulated its first ever first Middle East policy, a policy towards the Arab world in a very long time. And that really was just a reiteration of longstanding Chinese policy with little accommodation of the realities of what's going on in the region.
Sure. I think that's a really interesting angle to look at this, because I'm actually writing a paper I've been working on it this weekend, looking at that very question. One of the questions I constantly am asked at conferences and media engagements is, you know, how long can China sit on the fence? You know, eventually, it's going to have to choose, is it on the Arab side of the Gulf or the Iranian side of the Gulf? In such a tense regional security complex where there's a lot of competition and a lot of mistrust, for any great power to cultivate relations on both sides seems, I don't know, maybe untenable. And when my take from reading a lot of statements and documents from the Chinese government and Chinese academics and officials is, they don't really have a problem with this ambiguity of this set of relations. I think a lot of Western countries, particularly the U.S., sees it in a very, you know, kind of you're with us or you're with them situation. Their alliance system that Washington has adopted means that they're aligned, obviously, with the Gulf monarchies, and they've created this security order in the Gulf that excludes the region's biggest state and biggest military power. That, to me, seems a little more unsustainable, actually, to keep Iran in the cold doesn't really seem like a policy that's destined for a lot of success in the future. And I think that's what China's done. You know, with these partnerships rather than alliances, they focus on areas of cooperation. There are issues of where their interests don't align, but they kind of don't focus on that. They just focus on ways to cooperate, and they find ways to develop stronger ties, mostly economic, mostly trade or investment. And they've developed this kind of stronger presence on both sides of the Gulf. And I don't think they're ever really going to forsake that. I think the way they see it, and this might be maybe a bit naive, but the way Chinese leaders tend to talk about Middle East development is not through security, but through security, not through military means, but through development and through economic means. And I think the view is that the deeper economically they get in the Gulf and the stronger ties they create through this Belt and Road, the less pressing those security concerns are going to be. So kind of meandering here, but I think the way they see it is that eventually Iran is going to be a pretty important part of the Gulf order, and they want to be in a position where they can maintain relations on both sides, kind of like with the Qatar dispute.
The problem, of course, is that in many ways, Iran is a much more attractive partner in the Belt and Road than Saudi Arabia is. And, you know, particularly in the era of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia is going to have to balance some very contradictory policy goals. And the question is if Mohammed really sees Iran as an existential threat and is bent on ensuring that U.S. sanctions against Iran are effective and work, then China's sort of remaining aloof of this almost becomes unsustainable.
Sure. I think you hit on an important point. The political situation in Saudi, I think, has got to be a little worrying. Excuse me, for China, just because, it looks at times to be very unstable. And I think that's why we're seeing the UAE kind of becoming a bigger focus of China's GCC policy. I think the Gulf is the central pillar of China's Middle East policy, and I think the UAE is probably the pillar of the Gulf. You're right. Iran is very attractive just because it's a natural endpoint with this Belt and Road. There's that connectivity, and it's very easy to line up with a lot of other things they're doing. And Saudi, just because it looks unstable politically, it might not be the best place to invest heavily. And it's interesting because I was looking at trade stats last week, and for the first time ever, the UAE has become China's biggest trading partner in the Middle East. It overtook Saudi last year, and we hadn't seen that before. And I think we're seeing more and more. I mean, they've already got a very big physical presence in the Emirates compared to Saudi. There's a lot more Chinese nationals in Dubai and Abu Dhabi than you see in Saudi, and a lot more companies setting up their headquarters. So I think probably what we're seeing is kind of this UAE on the one side as where they're kind of planting their flag on one side of the Gulf. And in Iran, I don't think that's going anywhere. I've talked to Emirati academics and officials and diplomats, and they realize that the China-Iran relationship is very important, and they don't really have enough to offer to make it go away completely. I think they just want to make sure that they stay attractive enough to Chinese officials that they can maintain that relationship and develop it a little more.
I mean, the problem being, of course, that the UAE may be a bit more pragmatic about Iran than the Saudis, at least under the current government, are likely to be. But also much more fundamental issues. Iran is important in terms of connectivity to Europe, which Saudi Arabia is not. Iran has when leaves now sanctions aside, a far more educated population, a far larger population, a much bigger domestic market, has a historic relationship with China, and both China and Iran in many ways view themselves as almost former empires at the bookends of the Asian continent. So fundamentally, if you put that comparison on paper and looked at it, it's almost a hands down decision if you're forced to make a decision.
It is, but one way I kind of look at it is if you look at Iran as a single state, and you're right with all those kind of, they see themselves as these civilizational states with these thousands of years of history and an empire and Silk Road connections, and that certainly isn't the case with China and the Arabian Peninsula, although Oman has quite a long history with China. But if you look at it collectively, I mean, the value of trade between Iran versus collectively all the GCC states, it's not even close. You know, the Gulf monarchies dwarf the amount of trade that China does with Iran. And, you know, they also give China access to the Arab world in a bigger way that Iran can't really. You know, Iran has connections through the Middle East, through these non-state actors, but you know, Saudi and the UAE especially have you know, all of these close relations with Egypt and Jordan and Palestine and all these other states that, you know, those close relations, if China pursues that, it kind of opens the door a little more as well. So that's one thing Iran can offer. But you're right, the China-Iran relations have been longstanding, very important set of relationships.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, in strategic terms, your book sort of seeks to explain why China is interested in the Gulf and why the Gulf is interested in China. And obviously, there are the economic relationships, there are the changes in the energy market, with the United States becoming more or less self-sufficient in terms of oil and gas production, and therefore, and China rising as the, or having risen as the foremost market or alternative market for hydrocarbons from the Gulf. But beyond that economic relationship, which clearly goes beyond energy, is the Gulf also hedging, in a sense, against what is increasingly to them an unreliable U.S. ally, or is the engagement with Asia and China specifically far more strategic, or is it both? And if so, again, you know, if it is both, the question remains: does that complicate Chinese, you know, Chinese efforts to remain aloof to geopolitical issues? And at the end of the day, even more fundamentally, whether China can sustain these principles that it's had for decades that underlie its foreign and defense policy of non-interference, what you've alluded to, win-win economic situations, although some people argue it's China wins twice, and so on.
Win-win. Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, you as you know all too well, because you just interviewed my colleague and co-editor, Dr. Lee Chen Sim. We co-edited a book on the role of external powers in the Gulf. And what we saw was a lot of other states developing a pretty big position in the region, kind of under this umbrella of the U.S. security architecture. It's kind of a low-cost entry into the region. And we saw a lot of hedging behavior from a lot of Asian states, you know, India, Japan, South Korea, China, and also Western states like, you know, France and the UK. And I think everybody's been developing relations on all sides of the Gulf without having to kind of pay the cost of providing for the security and the trade. So a lot of states have been hedging, but I think the Gulf states themselves have been hedging really, really effectively. You know, I spoke with an Emirati academic a couple of months ago, and it was striking because obviously the relationship with Washington is so important. And everybody knows every element of what's happening in DC. They've got these lobbyists, and of course the ambassadorship to Washington is the most important one for all these Gulf states. English is the medium of instruction in all the universities. They're really oriented towards them, but they see these Asian countries as these really important rising markets and rising powers, and they want to get in on the ground floor there as well. They see that, as you mentioned, as the energy markets, lots of investment going that way, lots of investment from there coming into here. So they've been hedging as well. And when I asked this Emirati academic, I said, you know, my students at Zayed University, they know Western culture, Western history, Western philosophy. They've studied all this stuff, but they know very little about China. You know, do you think that this is an important relationship? And he kind of smiled and said, well, it is an important relationship. It's good for us right now. We're in a good position. We've got the EU and the US on our left, and on our right, we've got India and China. So, you know, we can look either way whenever we want or whenever we need to. So there is an element of hedging where they know that by building those relationships and deepening those relationships, they're making a very important option or opportunity for themselves. But strategically, another Emirati ambassador was talking with me recently, and he said, you know, when we look at what different powers, how they envision the Gulf, a lot of Western powers, especially the U.S., tends to look at the Gulf as just, you know, we've always been here, we always will. There isn't really a vision of why or going forward what the relationship will be. And I think, you know, Secretary of State Pompeo's speech in Cairo this weekend is further indication that they haven't really given a lot of thought of what it is they're doing here. And he contrasted that with China's Belt and Road and said, you know, they have a very, very clear idea of how we fit into their relationship and their strategic priorities. And that's very attractive to realize that we could be a part of something pretty powerful in the future. So I think there's a strategic element as well from this side.
I mean, that's without question true. I mean, China has a much more strategic approach in its policies than at least the Trump administration at this point does. But underlying that is almost the same question as with Iran, and that it's a very static view of affairs. It's sort of the assumption that nothing fundamentally will change, and you know, doesn't take at the very least black swans into account. So as much as one doesn't know where Saudi Arabia is going to go in terms of the importance it attributes to third parties like China adhering to U.S. sanctions against Iran, you know, if Robert Kaplan is right and the United States and China have already entered into what is a Cold War and no longer an attempt to seek cooperation, the question is whether you can straddle a middle ground for any extended period of time.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point, because no matter what angle people kind of look at this from, the U.S. is going to be an important factor. You know, I was in Beijing recently, and I was talking to a Chinese scholar at Peking University who works on Gulf politics. And I wanted to talk to him about this new UAE-China relationship, the strategic partnership. And every question I asked him came back to the trade war. You know, it wasn't really, he wasn't directly talking about China's Gulf situation as how China's relationship with Washington affects everything they're trying to do politically. So you're right. I think, you know, no matter how we look at things, the role of the U.S. in this is really central to what China is able to accomplish and what the Gulf states try to do as well.
Which really goes back to the question of the sustainability of China's foreign and defense policy principles. Because basically, I mean, if you look at Chinese Middle East policy over the last years, decade, maybe more, it's essentially been one in which cooperation with the United States or some sort of understanding with the United States of policy towards the Gulf and towards the Middle East at large was a key element of that. and increasingly, of course, with where the Middle East is going, whether it's the Saudi-Iranian crisis, the crisis in Yemen, the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, all of these different things, it seems to me that it's going to become increasingly difficult for the Chinese to maintain this.
Yeah, well, I think, again, coming at this from an IR perspective, President Obama gave a pretty famous speech with Tom Friedman, I think in 2015 or 16, where he, said China's a free rider. And China's been free riding in the Gulf. And other people have said, and you just kind of alluded to it, kind of been bandwagoning, looking at following along with U.S. policies to continue to derive benefits. And the way I kind of look at it is more from this hedging perspective that they're, a good hedger is going to develop those economic ties and slowly build up capabilities to the point where if something does happen, they're positioned. And, they haven't been doing that militarily because they haven't had to, but the base in Gwadar in Pakistan and the base in Djibouti indicates that might be coming. The base in Duqm in Oman, not the base, the port rather, that Chinese firms from Ningxia have been developing to the tune of something like $11 billion. This is going to have military or naval capacity because when Prime Minister Modi visited Muscat last year, they signed an agreement to use Duqm for, I think, refueling and replenishment and repair for the Chinese or the Indian Navy rather. So they're slowly building up, kind of and quietly building up these capabilities that indicate that they're not going to keep hedging forever. That eventually, if the U.S. slips, or if the situation calls for it, for China to protect its interests in a more proactive way, that the capacity might be there. Now, I don't see this happening anytime soon. I don't think, why would anybody want to destabilize this essentially really good deal that they have right now? But I think, given what you described, this very kind of Cold War mentality of this bilateral China-U.S. relationship right now, they have to be looking to the future and thinking, well, the energy and the investment and the expatriate population and the business communities that we have in these countries is important. We have to protect it. And there could be a point where they are a little more assertive in managing their own interests in the region.
In a sense, you're alluding, in my mind, at least, to several things. One is, this could come sooner than later if you get a Cold War, because if you get a Cold War and competitive cooperation no longer is the principle, is your enemy in the Cold War the one you want to rely on for the security of your energy supplies? And so it strikes me that the Chinese could be confronted with that decision much earlier. And your reference to Gwadar also leads you into, if the Saudis and the Americans, for that matter, step up their efforts to change things in Iran by trying to destabilize the regime, then Gwadar comes into play very centrally, mm-hmm. One, because of the Iranian port of Chabahar, which sure. The Saudis have already indicated identified as a threat, but also because Balochistan, which is home to the port of Gwadar, becomes a launching pad for insurgency and efforts to destabilize. And then China really doesn't have a lot of choices left.
Absolutely. And it gets really messy very quickly, because you mentioned Chabahar, and of course India has been investing heavily there. And you mentioned Balochistan, which, there have been rumors that Saudi had been involved in destabilization campaigns there to direct it towards Tehran. So, all of this stuff gets very, very messy quickly. And there's so many different balls in the air. And again, a lot of it comes back to what the U.S. wants to do. This Indo-Pacific strategy and the national defense document that the Trump White House released in December 2017, I think. This was a very, it reads like a containment document, like containing China. And it seems, the Indo-Pacific, as the other Quad states and the Obama administration had kind of envisioned it, was this socialization mechanism to build up this liberal rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific. But the way that the Trump administration has described it has been much more aggressive, and it's been targeting China. It mentions the Belt and Road as a threat to a lot of American allies. And so you can see how a lot of regional states might have to pick, do they want to get involved in this? And we've seen, with the Quad, for example, India doesn't seem to really have an interest in poking Beijing to make Washington happy. So there could be a lot of really interesting geopolitics, getting back to Kaplan here, taking place, and the Gulf could easily become a theater of this. You can see how this competition across the Indo-Pacific is going to have these different pressure points. And the Arabian Peninsula, with both of those choke points for energy and all of the FDI going both ways, it could really be an important theater of this competition.
We've talked a lot about Saudi Arabia and the UAE. You've opted in the book to use three case studies, Oman being beyond Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the third one. Can you explain why you chose those three, and particularly Oman, and where you see the similarities and the differences?
Well, those three, that's a really good question. I mean, initially I was hoping to do, all of the Gulf states, and it was clear that to kind of theoretically look at it the way I wanted to, I couldn't. So I had to kind of pick and choose. And Saudi, of course, just because it is, probably the most important Arab state right now in a lot of ways, where, I think Egypt always was in the past. Saudi, with its role in energy markets and its geostrategic importance, bordering all those different Arab states and the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf and the, it's very important geopolitically, and of its role in Islam, which for China, of course, is very important. Something like 22 million Muslims in China. The relationship with Saudi can be very important in managing China's pretty difficult relationship with its Muslim population. So that was the reasoning behind Saudi. For the UAE, just because the UAE was very interesting. When you look at the trade relations of the GCC states with China, the imbalance almost always favors the Gulf, because the value of energy exports has been so much greater than the value of what they export to China. And that's not the case with two: Bahrain, which exports almost nothing to China, and the UAE, which exports a lot to China, but imports a whole lot more. The China-UAE trade relationship is very peculiar when you look at the GCC states, because they import so much more from China than they export to it. So this relationship, from an economic perspective, is pretty interesting. You can see the UAE's re-export model as China's a pretty important actor in that. There's a lot of more Chinese companies and Chinese nationals in the UAE than any other Gulf state. And they have just a much bigger physical presence. So I thought that was kind of an interesting reason to look at that. In Oman, just because, the history is so cool between Oman and China. China was supporting this rebellion in the Dhofari province back in the late 60s, early 70s, trying to undermine the Omani sultanate to overthrow monarchy, with the goal of eventually overthrowing all of the Gulf monarchies and creating these, communist republics. And when Sultan Qaboos came into power in 71, that started to shift, and it eventually became, very relatively quickly a pretty important partner with China in the region. Oman diplomatically punches above its weight across a lot of pretty important issues. So from a foreign policy perspective, I thought Oman was pretty interesting. And from a strategic perspective, I thought it was really cool as well, because, that long coastline means that they can actually get around the choke point of the Hormuz Straits, that they have these ports that give them access to energy, that they don't have to worry, the threat, whether or not it would ever happen, of Iran closing the straits. Well, Oman gives them an opportunity to forgo that. So, it was pretty interesting to me diplomatically, historically, and strategically. I thought with Bahrain, the issue was that there wasn't really as much history or trade. The data didn't really, there wasn't really, it was going to be an issue of data collection. There wasn't really enough about Bahrain to really warrant a standalone case study. Kuwait and Qatar, I mean, they would be really interesting. And I hope I'm planning another kind of bigger project, and I'd like to delve more into those two. Kuwait, just because they were the first Gulf state to diplomatically recognize China. They've been working pretty closely on this Silk Road or New Silk City, Madinat al-Harir in Kuwait, with a lot of Chinese FDI going into this, linking it to the Belt and Road. So it's also a pretty important relationship, but I felt that the other three were a little more, it's just more interesting, I think, across a range of issues.
I want to come back to some of the points you just made, but let's go back to Oman for a second. And you've described part of the importance of Oman in terms of its ports of Sohar, Salalah, Tukun, which really links into the maritime component of the Belt and Road Initiative. And it struck me that, and of course, China's been very active in ports in the UAE with Jebel Ali and so on. But it struck me sort of as interesting that within that Chinese port strategy, Saudi ports like Jeddah don't seem to have really played an important role.
Yeah, they seem to be working more on energy issues with Saudi. You know, there's been Saudis looking at building these nuclear reactors, and Chinese firms have been pretty active in working towards that and using nuclear energy to power their desalination plants, and obviously the Aramco IPO that may or may not happen. Chinese firms look pretty keen to get in on that. But you're right, in terms of they've also built this refinery in Yanbu. So it's more, I guess, more energy focused infrastructure, although they did build the Mecca Medina Jeddah high speed railroad, which was a pretty important prestige project for Chinese firms. But in terms of ports, yeah, Duqm, Qizad, and Abu Dhabi, the Khalifa port, and Jebel Ali seem to be the big story for what China's trying to do.
It's sort of interesting that Saudi Arabia hasn't wanted to have a port of that status versus the Chinese. There's, of course, Yanbu, but the other significance of Jeddah is, of course, the religious significance as being the entry point to Mecca, which, again, given China's focus on religion at the moment, including Islam, one would think that the Chinese would want to have some influence there.
Yeah, you would. And I really don't know what the issue is, if it's on Saudi side or whether it's on China's side.
Let me come back to some of the other issues that you've raised. You rightfully so noted that China views the Gulf as a sort of a stable subsection of a volatile region, although one could argue that increasingly that may be a wrong premise, and at the same time, of course, in terms of importance, the Gulf states' ability to sort of set the international oil market and manipulate oil prices and supply and demand increasingly is no longer a given. So the question is, in a sense, from that perspective, who needs more whom? Does China need the Gulf more? Does the Gulf need China more?
Yeah, well, it's a fair point. I think it's somewhat balanced. And you're right, when you talk about the relative stability, it's really funny to describe the Gulf as a stable subregion, given, you know, the three major wars that they've had in the past 30 odd years. But I guess when I look at, you know, a lot of indicators for the rest of the Middle East, you know, like the PPP or GDP per capita, or, you know, median age and population growth and all these things, it really is a pretty stable hub, at least in the Arab world. And you know, the constant threat of, you know, something happening with Iran, I guess just that U.S. security umbrella makes it, you know, a somewhat stable region. And I think you look at it, you know, that big contract with China signed with Russia for its oil and gas, that whatever it was, a 20-year multi-billion-dollar agreement that signed, I believe, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And China's presence in places like Africa, and you know, there are other ways to get a lot of what they get from the Gulf. But again, I think a lot of folks in the Gulf, when they look at it historically, it's always been a hub, you know, across different empires or a lot of different civilizations. And to get anywhere, you've got to pass through the Arabian Peninsula or pass through the Gulf. And the geography is not going to change. It's always going to be a pretty important meeting point. And, you know, even if they don't need to import any more Gulf energy, they're still going to want to use it, their infrastructure for connectivity, their airlines, their ports, connecting to South Asia, Central Asia, East Africa. They're really well positioned to take advantage of whatever great power wants, you know, to implement some great new initiative. And right now, China's the one with the big new initiative, and I think that's kind of the story.
That's probably certainly true from the Gulf's perspective. From the Chinese perspective, there's, of course, on the one hand, the sustainability of and the security of the flow of energy, but also they have an interest in what oil prices do and what supply and demand does. And there, it seems to me that the Gulf's influence is reduced, and that there are other, you know, and that the Gulf through OPEC needs to be aligning itself with non-OPEC producers, which also means for China that it needs to ensure that it has those producers on board.
Sure, that's a really good point. I mean, we've seen this with the reports in the past week of Saudi wanting to reduce production to try to drive prices up, because obviously they like oil at $80 barrels to cover their federal budget. And so that seems to fundamentally put them at odds with China, right? That China would like to see, given the tremendous volume of imports, they'd like a say in the price. And it's interesting. That brings me back to the kind of IR perspective. When we talk about the stability of the region or this idea of free riding or bandwagoning, I spoke with a Chinese scholar who is really adamant that China's not doing either, that China's paying a huge premium in its oil imports because of U.S. mismanagement of the region or U.S. Adventurism. You know, those incredible oil prices from last decade as a result of the Iraq War had a big effect on China's economy. So you're right. I think they'd like to have a bigger say in how the markets work, given their importance as a export destination.
We've talked a lot about, from a Chinese perspective, but also more generally, Saudi Arabia being the key state. And we've talked about, you know, the balancing act given Saudi-Iranian relations. There is, of course, one other state that is probably as powerful as Iran is, minus the energy reserves, and that's Turkey. And the Turkey relationship is, of course, under stress, certainly since the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in October of last year, but also because of Turkey's own ambitions.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I'm certainly no expert on Turkish domestic or international politics, but it's a really important thing to look at in the Gulf, because obviously they're kind of projecting themselves as a leading role in the Middle East, and that's brought them at odds with the UAE and Saudi in particular. And it's interesting looking at the Chinese angle, because you know that China's Central West Asia economic corridor brings them right in through Turkey as an endpoint in giving them access to, you know, Piraeus port in Greece and all of what they're trying to do in Southern Europe. So That's an important relationship for China, but it's not really an uncomplicated one, just because of the, you know, the situation with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, where ethnic Turkic people that relationship, I think, has been under some strain because of this as well. So there's just so much that goes into that China-Turkey and Turkey-Gulf set of relations that really complicates things. And also the fact that Turkey is both a NATO member, but is considering or is being considered as a future Shanghai Cooperation Organization member. That would bring them into a lot closer contact with China on security issues, which you think would probably not be looked at very favorable in the Gulf. So there's so much going on with all of these relationships. It's really tough to keep all those balls in the air.
Before I come back to the Uyghurs for a second, you actually raised an interesting point with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where you have a situation where Iran is an observer, whereas none of the Gulf states have that status. And there's always been this question of Iran becoming a member of the SCO, of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And my sense has been that one reason why it hasn't become a member is not only Iran's international status versus the United States, but also if it were a member, it could actually veto any attempt by Saudi Arabia, for example, to become a member.
Yeah, this to me is a really, I wrote a short piece for the Monkey Cage a couple of years ago about what would happen, you know, when Pakistan and India were made full members. I thought, well, this is really interesting, because this kind of opens the door for bringing other regional competitors into the fold. And with Iran's status, it made me think, well, if Iran gets in, then of course I would expect the UAE and Saudi to want to as well. And there's a whole lot of factors, I guess, that come into play there. One of them being that, like you say, when they always said Iran can't because it was under these international sanctions. And the deal was when the sanctions were gone, then the path to membership was open. But I really don't think that China wants to antagonize Washington, and bringing Iran into the fold would certainly do that. So I think as long as the relationship between Iran and the U.S. remains as contentious as it is right now, then there's not going to be a lot of interest in Beijing to kind of poke the U.S. in the eye. For the Gulf states, just looking at it neutrally, it would make a lot of sense. You know, this is a lot of states that they invest in, a lot of states they export to, a lot of pretty important countries are part of the SCO, so they would want a say in trying to shape the agenda. But at the same time, they're so reliant on the U.S. Security umbrella. And, Washington, I think, sees the SCO as quite an affront or a future competitor. So I think they'd have to take that into consideration as well. Is it worth antagonizing the U.S. to take part of this relation or this organization that really hasn't achieved a whole lot, you know, that they can hang their hats on right now? So, you know, it might be good for the status, but it could cause more problems than it solves.
You noted that, you know, the Saudi religious establishment, as much of the Muslim world for that matter, has refrained from denouncing the Chinese crackdown on the Turkic Muslims in Xinjiang. On the other hand, the Saudis project themselves as a leader, if not the leader, of the Muslim world and the custodians of the holy cities, Mecca and Medina. And you're seeing a slow but gradual break in that front of silence towards what's happening in Xinjiang and increasingly now in India with the Wei Muslims, and again, also with other religious groups, Christians and so on. And the question is, as that front of silence breaks, and if Western nations not only keep up their criticism of what's happening in Xinjiang, but may even go take some sort of retaliatory action, how long Saudi Arabia can maintain that, on the one hand. On the other hand, you could argue that by remaining silent, countries like Saudi Arabia have a lot of leverage with China because China depends mm-hmm. on that silence. But if you get that continued buildup of criticism, that becomes, I would think, also domestically in a country like Saudi Arabia, a very tricky issue.
It is tricky, but I think this is a case where state interests kind of trump kind of the ideational or religious or ideological concerns. I don't agree with this, but I'm no expert on Xinjiang, so I'm just talking kind of as a layperson here. But the way China frames the situation in Xinjiang is, a response to instability and a group that wants to separate, and one of the three evils of splitism, and they frame it in such a way that makes it easier for countries like Pakistan or the UAE or Saudi to say, yeah, they're dealing with a domestic political situation. A lot of these countries have their own problems with political Islam. And as long as China's able to frame it that way, then I think it's easier. It gives them a kind of an out to not have to condemn it. Excuse me. And again, it's not that I see it that way. It's just that's the way it's being described. And I think a lot of leaders in Gulf states would say, well, yeah, if you look at, Daesh or the Muslim Brotherhood or these other political Islamist movements, these have been pretty big domestic problems for them. And if China says Xinjiang is the same for China, then it makes it a little easier for them to kind of navigate that question. The other issue, I think, is just that, the China's non-interference in the domestic politics of its allies or its partner states, from those five principles of peaceful cooperation, that's appreciated in the region. China tends to work with states and not support groups that threaten state security or state stability. And those states, especially after 2011, appreciated it. It was kind of a interesting counterpoint from the U.S. supporting protesters in a lot of countries and what China saw as creating instability. So I think that all comes, it's all bound together in this stuff. Also the fact that, after Tiananmen, there weren't too many states where China could go and receive a state visit, but the Gulf was one set of countries where they could. The Chinese president, Yang Shengkun, came to Oman and the UAE, Qatar, and Egypt and was received very spectacularly. That certainly wasn't going to happen in too many other places. So I think they're able to kind of look at state stability and religious freedom as maybe different sides of the same coin.
Jonathan, you and I could go on for hours about this.
There's a lot, yeah.
Unfortunately, we're coming slowly to the end of this. But before I let you go, perhaps you can talk a little bit about where you're going from here in terms of your research and projects.
Sure. I mean, this book was kind of like step one. There's so much to look at with China and the Gulf and China and the Middle East. One thing I'm working on, I've got an edited book that I'm putting together called Regions in the Belt and Road Initiative. I've got a really great team of scholars with regional expertise. And the idea is what happens when China, through its Belt and Road Initiative, kind of gets inserted into these regional security complexes where they haven't traditionally always played a very big role. Are they going to kind of get sucked into this vortex of regional security concerns, or are they going to be able to maintain their, business first approach? So that's one thing I'm working on, but I guess the bigger project is just looking at how the Belt and Road is being implemented in the Middle East. This idea of Asian states coming into the Gulf and how this might affect the security landscape or the business landscape or the economic one. Is there going to be kind of a greater emphasis on East Asia or South Asia in general? I guess just Asia in general rather than the West, which is what we've always kind of seen in the Gulf. This is the kind of stuff I want to look at for the next couple of years.
Well, it sounds to me like you've got your research cut out for you.
Full plate.
With more than one great project. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and wish you all the best.
Cheers, James, and thanks. This is a really great podcast. Really enjoy it.